Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities. I'm your host, Lisa Zimmer, and I'm very happy to bring our guest to you today. It is author and investment advisor, Bruce Farrell Rosen, who wrote, "If you ever need me, I won't be far away." Bruce really brings to the table a heartfelt message in regard to how his spiritual evolution, his awareness, his perceptions really evolved through life's challenges that grabs all of us in unexpected ways and times in our lives. And Bruce wrote a really heartfelt book that really spoke to me in such a kindred spirit way, as well as the similarities of so many things that he pointed out in life that happens to all of us at some point. But without further ado, I want to bring Bruce to you guys because he has some great insights and perceptions. And even though he's in the world of analytical investment advisory, he is also an extremely intuitive, heartfelt soul. So without further ado, Bruce Rosen, thank you so much for being my guest today on Unlimited Realities. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. This is a very this was one of those books where you pick it up. It reminded me of actually someone who endorsed your book. It reminded me of a book I read, Jeff Brown's Soul Shaping, because it was really heartfelt and it really grabbed me on that realm. And then I'm looking at the back of the book after I read it, and I see he endorsed your book. So.
Yeah, yes, he gave a very nice comment and I think a very sensitive comment about we all sort of walk different paths, but we walk very, very similar paths in life.
It's amazing the kindredness there. So I'm reading the book, and there's so many things that hit me. As an intuitive, I was very drawn to the part about you talking about Lorraine Rose, and we're going to get into that aspect. And I want to really congratulate you in being such an open heart and spirit, being somebody who deals with such an analytical profession. I mean, you're really kind of enmeshed in a world of numbers and figures and left brain thinking, and yet your book is completely heartfelt and right brain. So, you know, it was really, really nice to read. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Lisa. Yes, it is certainly a different world that I exist in by day, and by night I become more of the person I believe that I truly am, but although that other side is also the person I am.
Oh, it's a great integration. Now, let's start with what, you know, the book is extremely heartfelt. It's very, very soulfully written. What was your inspiration overall in writing the book?
There are probably a few important influences in writing the book. Number one, as you read the book, you'll come to know my very gifted mother, Alma Lorraine Rose, or actually Rush was her last name, but she was a psychic that went by the name of Alma Rose. And I felt that in writing this book, I became closer and closer to her spirit. She mm-hmm. departed in 1999 as a result of cancer, and from that moment on, I have been open to her voice and her spirit. And I think that in writing this book, I became even more open to the messages of my mom, perhaps even more than the ones that she gave me in life. So I think one of the big inspirations in this book was being in touch with the spirit of my mom.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say there are probably a few other very important influences or moments. The separation from my wife, who I will always continue to love, even though the love isn't bounded by a marriage anymore. That separation was rather difficult for both of us, because I think there was a soul connection there and a very spiritual connection between us.
Right.
And I think that separation put me in a place mentally to have to come to terms with the choices we make, the choices we don't make. Why do we make choices? Do we have much choice in some of the choices we make? What are the limitations, you know, to our choices? Trying to understand life as it unfolded, and to come to terms with that separation in the privacy and the somewhat loneliness of a new life.
Right. It's that it becomes that free will decision making that's a gift, but also such a responsibility when you make that choice, because it sets the course of path. And you have tremendous forks in the road here throughout the book in regard to where you were in your perception, where you were in life, and how circumstances started to present themselves on your path, and how you looked at it in regard to, were you going to embrace it, ignore it, full steam ahead? There were so many areas that in reading the book, I really became... familiar with your energy, with you, because it was as if there was parts that you were talking about your mother when she started to do intuitive work, and it was almost like somebody was writing about my life.
Like
I'm thinking, I'm reading it, and I'm going, oh man, this is too much. So let's talk a little bit. Your mother's a really amazing
conversation we were meant to have then.
Yeah, I know there is definitely a kindred
yeah.
connection here.
Yeah.
Now you've got your mother is Alma Rush, and she
right.
married your father Larry. And she also went about her life in a way where, you know, she took her responsibility as a mother extremely as a very, very strong responsibility. And she obviously did an incredible job in her mothering and in her rearing of her children. Your experience with your father was a little different. He wasn't as present, shall we say,
right.
as he could have been. And there was many things that you went through in the unfolding of your relationships with both of your parents that I really saw the connectedness of how you were raised, where she raised, there was four of you, right? Four children?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay.
I'm the eldest of four.
Okay, because I have four children too, and I saw the similarity of how she raised you guys in how I raised my children, where she never really stunted your intuitive voice. She really encouraged you to feel on that perceptional level, and yet, you know, she put up with the unpredictability of your father. So what did you learn from that relationship in watching your mother raise you and watching your father's interaction? Was there a different perception you gained as you were growing up in the household with here's your mother who is advising others with her intuition, and then they're really not getting support from her husband in regard
right.
to who she was, and really not getting validated on that truth either. So
right,
how did your perception evolve as you were growing up, like going through puberty and teenage years, you know?
Mm-hmm. Very good question, and very extremely perceptive. I've often felt that if I were given the choice, and maybe I was given the choice prior to coming into this world, that you could have a mother that was absolutely amazing, a mentor, a teacher, a guide, a spirit, a friend, compassionate, giving, loving, the mother in the fullest sense. If you could have a mother like that, but at the same time come into a world with an angry, sometimes violent, erratic, volatile, but yet, you know, he had some qualities that are good, obviously, and I want to touch upon those in answer to your question in a moment. But if somebody said to, if God said to me, a spirit said to me, you could have this kind of mother and a father that was going to be abusive and actually be damaging in some ways growing up, but you'll learn from that father, it won't be easy. It'll be painful. It'll be hard. There'll be a lot to overcome. There'll be sadness. and there'll be anger, but you could have that kind of mother. What would you take it, or would you rather have a different situation of two more balanced parents, but not the kind of mother you ended up with? I would have taken the mother that I
right,
had
right.
because she was absolutely amazing. I think in for all the reasons, and if when you read the book, you'll, as you pointed out, you'll see and hear and learn more about her. In answer to your question, I think that there were a few things I learned in growing up as I went through adolescence. Number one was I always wanted, number one, to have a loving, committed marriage, to be an equal partner in my marriage. And I felt that my father wasn't that, and I wanted to have that so much when I would one day be married and have children. I wanted to be a father, the kind of father I didn't have. I wanted to be there for them. I wanted to teach them. I wanted to give them my essence, to learn from them, to be there for them, to be a father, to be at their events, to be at their games, to take part in their lives, to enjoy the beings that I have brought into this world, and to mentor them to the best of my ability, and to be a father for the rest of my life, one that they can count on, and that they would one day be grown men that with whom I would share a great deal. And I do truly believe that I have gone on that path as a husband and a father, even though the marriage, sadly, as I've alluded to, it lasted a long time, and it was a very successful marriage, and we still stay very close and friends, but we're not within the confines of the marriage anymore. So I think I've realized that dream of a long marriage with lots of love, and I became the kind of father that I wanted to become. On the positive side, I realized that my father was a very, very hard-working person, and he was committed to his work, and he did it well. And so on the positive side, that is a trait that I wanted to take with me as well, or that I learned growing up, that I could be I could be both. I could be a committed working person, intense and focused on what I do, but also be the kind of husband and father that I wanted to be.
Right, right. And was in regard to your mother, did she ever, in regard to doing her work and raising you as children, was it ever looked at by you kids as something not to talk about outside of the house, or to, to keep under wraps, or because sometimes, you know, intuitive psychics are looked at kind of as flakes, you know, they just are, and believe me, there's a lot of them out there.
And there are some flakes out there. I'm sure there are. My mom was incredibly gifted as a psychic, but more than just being a psychic, she was a mother. She was
right.
a very warm and down-to-earth and simple person, and people came from all over the world to see her. Some of the biggest names in show business, as well as the very poor and downtrodden that couldn't even afford a reading but needed guidance.
Right.
So that's the kind of person she was. So she wasn't out there. And so we grew up with her abilities, and for us as kids growing up, it was very matter of fact. It was very realistic. This is life, and this is the stuff she saw. Now, there were friends that I had that when they heard about it, or their parents, I think there were some parents that were probably, wow, that woman is that woman's a witch or something. But I don't think that ever really came back to me, although I think there were probably some of those perceptions out there. But I think as some of even the neighbors, you know, we lived in kind of a middle-class suburban area in Southern California growing up, and as some of the neighbors learned of her abilities, many of them wanted readings.
Right.
And they would come down the street for readings, and they were blown away by them, and she converted many, many skeptics. And so I think, no, the answer is I did not feel alienated or estranged in any way by her abilities because it was so natural to me. And
right.
I found really more than scared, people were intrigued and wanted to learn more. And I had a girlfriend growing up in high school, very smart girl. Her sister, the family, very smart. The father and the mother, very skeptical of God, skeptical of intuition, skeptical. I mean, very science oriented. And I think it was a good relationship with the girl that I met at the time, Lauren, because she deeply wanted to believe in something beyond science. And
right.
I actually could learn from her and her parents about the hardcore material world, and she learned a great deal and became very, very attached to my mom. Even after the relationship ended, she learned a great deal from me about that other world, about trusting your intuition. She learned immensely from my mom and even her very skeptical parents. The father was given a reading once, and he had to admit, in an almost agnostic but accepting kind of way, well, maybe there's something to this.
Yeah, I always get a kick out of turning a skeptic into a believer.
I saw many that were absolutely hardcore. One was a physicist. One was worked on a one of the space missions. Brilliant, absolutely. We're talking rocket scientist.
Right.
Brilliant man that came to her and wound up coming to her many, many more times after that.
Right, right. And that's, you know, it's one of those things where when you have someone who is tapped in and they come out with information that there's no way you could have possibly have given them or they would know, it does tend to make your mind expand a bit because, you know, there's a connection out there that we're all able to tap into. Some, however, are more tapped in than others, naturally. And, you know, you talk a lot in your book about your mom and your the death of your mother. And you lost your mom in 1999. I lost my mom in 2002. And she was a very strong feature in my life with my kids and with me. And she was a friend as well as my mom. She was a great mother. She was a great grandmother. And you talk a lot about her death in regard to it sounds like, for me in reading your book, that you really started to open up a whole different part of who you were upon your mother's passing in regard to your heart and your perceptions and your intuition. I mean, even though you still had developed your intuitive voice, it sounds like it really exploded, evolved with the passing of your mother. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you perceive your growth after your mother's passing?
Yes. I think that when a person is in the flesh, and the spirit is in the flesh, first of all, I treasured my mom in life and tried to capture the moments with her and commit them to memory and tried to record her voice in my mind and her smile and her laugh, which was incredible, a healing laugh that was infectious. So in life, I treasured her. I knew she was unique and special, not only as a mom, but to everybody out there that ever met her. When she passed, at that moment, I went into a very... Well, I think God gives us, or the Spirit gives us, the ability to accept loss when one needs to accept it. And it was very, very painful, but I found an inner peace, and I found her spirit when I allowed myself to go to a quiet place. And after she passed and I overcame the grief, I felt that I was even more connected to her spirit, and I could, you know, it's not that I heard her voice every day, but I felt that often she would visit, or her
right.
presence would be felt, and a couple of things. There's a certain scent that she had, almost a tobacco. It's hard to describe. Almost a smell of perfume and tobacco and smoke and almost like the peat of a Scotch whiskey and tobacco and perfume and roses. You know, I mean, a combination of a number of things. And a period of time would go by where I wouldn't have that scent, and then I would smell it, and I would, and whenever I smell it, I know she is present, and it comes and it goes, and it's an amazing
right.
feeling, because sometimes it just comes over me. I took a trip to England a few years after she passed, and there was a tea, which I'd never had here in America or in California, and I tasted it in a fine hotel in London, and I asked the host what kind of tea that was, because the taste of the tea and the scent of the tea reminded me of my mom, and I'd never wow. tasted anything like it. And she told me that it was this South African red tea, which again I'd never a naturally decaffeinated tea called rubash or rubus. And I asked where I could get it. She said, there's only one place you can get it outside of this hotel that she knew about, and it was Harrod's department store in the pantry where they sell specialty things.
Uh-huh.
I went and got it, and I had them send a whole bunch of boxes back. Maybe a year or two after that, it became available here. And ever since then, it's high in antioxidants, so it's very healthy. It's naturally decaffeinated, and it has the scent, at least to me, of my mom.
Wow.
So it's really powerful. I'll tell you one other, I'll tell a relatively quick story that brings my mom into the present for me. And it was this moment, I think, that precipitated a incredible closeness with my mom, but also with intuition and trusting it. And trusting that what you feel and perceive might just be very real, even though you can't see it and touch it.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after my mom passed, I was grieving intensely, and I took about a week and a half off of work. And I went for a walk one morning, and I have two boys. They were at a school up the street together here in San Francisco. And there was a park across the street from the school, and I went for a walk. It was early in the afternoon, and I had hoped to perhaps see the boys walking home on the way back from my walk. So as I walked along this beautiful park overlooking San Francisco, I went to the other side of the park and sat down on a fence looking down upon the street, just above the street, just down the street from the school. Now, the title of my book is If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away. And those are words that my mom gave to me shortly before she passed. And she was still conscious at that time and relatively clear, but passing fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sat down and on this fence, and I started to sob.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, if anybody, I'm sure many out there have experienced grief, and it almost comes upon you like a torrential downpour.
Right.
It opens up at like a monsoon, almost pours out of you, and then you're okay, and it may come back again, and it will come back again, but over time it's less and less frequent until you start to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through one of those brief monsoon torrential downpours, and I'm sitting on this fence. And I said to myself, I said it out loud. I said, Mom, you said that before you passed that you would always be there if I needed you. You would always just be there on the other side. Well, I really need to know. I really need a sense, a feeling. I need to be shown that you're really there. Somehow show me. So I've never seen my mom on a sign or a license plate or her name is Alma, A-L-M-A, and it's not that common a name.
Right.
And I've never seen it any. Frankly, truly, I've never seen it anywhere that I could ever remember, certainly at that point, never since. And As I get up from this fence and start walking down the street, literally within about 15 seconds, I am looking at a license plate that says Alma, spelled out, A-L-M-A, Loves, L-O-V-E-S, and the number 10. And I am just in absolute amazement. You know, and how does that happen? And what kind of synchronicity produced that? And all I could I thought, well, I'm in the right place. I had to see that. I had to ask that question.
Right.
And I was given an answer. And I started to count 10. And I started to think of the people that she truly did love in her life. And I have to say that I counted no more or no less than 10.
Wow. Wow.
That's and that story
an incredible
is, you know,
story.
As is in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, that is an incredible story. I mean, that's one of those fateful moments where you know that you're not far from God's touch. You know, God's there. God's there when you need God to be there regardless. And, you know, there's that connection with your mother that will always be there. And, you know, as I'm listening to you talk about smells, I had to kind of chuckle within myself because my kids tease me about how acute my sense of smell is. And so I have a really strong sense of smell, and I'll get a little shiver that I'll sense my mother's energy around me, and I will smell the rose smell. And when you said that, I almost just like, that was just like an incredible thing. So I'm wondering if Ruth and Alma are up there just, you know, kvetching and having a great time.
Enjoying this conversation.
But you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of similarities in the ethers there. So you've got this incredible spirit of Alma Rush, who used Lorraine Rose as her professional name as an intuitive, and
right.
she did a lot of you know, common people or middle class or like you said even poor people, but she also did celebrities and stars, one being Marlon Brando that you talk about in the
yes.
book.
Yes.
And I imagine that had to have been a very interesting read. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for
that. She told me a little bit about it, but she never really divulged to me the intimate details of any of her other readings, but
right.
I did come home, a little vignette here. I was off at college, and I came home as I would. I was up in Santa Barbara going to college at the time, UC Santa Barbara, and my mom lived about 90 miles from Santa Barbara, California, to the south, just north of Los Angeles. And I came home from college for winter break, and I'd gone out to have a few beers with some friends that night, and I don't think I'd seen my mom at all that day, and I'd just gotten home. And I come home, and it's kind of late, and I've had a couple beers, and she's on the phone, and she's giggling and laughing and chuckling, and she, you know, doesn't really pay too much attention to me when I walk in, and she acknowledges me, but she's really engrossed in this conversation, and she's laughing, and so when she gets off the phone, I said, and she went on for a while, and I said, Mom, you know, God, I mean, you must have been enjoying that conversation. What was that about? And she said, well, I just got off the phone with Marlon Brando, and he just asked me out on a date. And I said, you're kidding me. Why? How? What? How? Why? And she said, well, I've been reading him for a while, and I asked her, well, was he at the house? And she said, yes, once. And did you go there to his place? And she said, yes, a couple times, but most of the readings took place on the phone, and he was having difficulties with, or he really loved a woman, an Asian woman in his life, and he wanted to understand it, and she was helping with it, but he started to become kind of infatuated with my mom, and he just asked her out, so I said, well, tell me more, and she didn't really tell me a whole lot more, but I think the readings with Marlon Brando went on, you know, for a good several months after that. But she never did. She never did go out with him. She said no, I can't do that. And she told him on the phone, no, I can't do that. So that's a little vignette about Marlon Brando. And she read a number of other people, some incredibly stunning, beautiful actresses that I was, you know, I couldn't believe it were, you know, leaving the house, you know, as I walked in, and some, you know, really well-known people out there, you know, which I probably won't go into, she did that, and she also read for, as I say, the people that couldn't afford a reading but needed help.
And you know, there's this piece in the book that you talk about. Let's get into the faded connection in regard to meeting your wife, Susan. You talk also, because you know what really is refreshing to me is that you were raised at a time when there was really conservative values in America, and your mother kind of really helped evolve you in a way of not really boxing you in one specific, you know, theology or belief system. And
Correct. It
seems like you really expanded a lot at a young age because of that ability of really being open-minded. And you went to see Alma in regard to a soulmate, right? And you were really
right.
Wanting that connection, that kind of unity, that soul connection. And
right.
Let's talk a little bit about that. How did that unfold? Because
that was a really powerful moment. And if anybody, including myself, could be skeptical about if I would ever allow skeptical thoughts to enter into my head, which they never did, but if skepticism were to ever find a place, it would be forever banished after this particular situation.
Right.
I was up at this point. I'd moved on from college in Santa Barbara, and I was living in San Francisco, my home, and ever since. And I was at grad school in another situation where I had come home for break. And it was a beautiful, pristine, gorgeous Southern California day in early summer. And I wanted a reading from my mom because I really wanted to know. I felt I was ready to meet my partner in life. I just wanted it so badly. And I'd been dating a few people, and it wasn't that kind. I met some nice people, but I didn't feel that kind of connection that it would last, that anybody I was going to marry. So I'd asked my mom for a reading, and I made a plan for that reading in advance, and she set aside some time, and we went out in the back patio overlooking sort of a high desert area, overlooking the mountains of Southern California. As I say, a beautiful day, and she did the reading in the backyard. And she would... the process was that you'd drink the tea. She turned the teacup upside down, and she would say, turn it around three times and make a wish. And so I did, and then she would open the teacup, turn it over, you know, hit it a couple of times with her hand and knock out some leaves, and then look at the patterns and the images that would develop. And she said, I can see your wish very clearly. And she said, your wish, Bruce, is to be in love. And she says, it's on the verge of happening. She says, and she turned the cup over, and she says, look. She said, all through your cup are Cupids and Valentine hearts. It's everywhere around you. It's just on the verge of happening. She says, but don't go looking for it or seeking it because you can't find it. It's the person you're meant to meet is going to find you, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's nobody that you already know. She will find you. That's how it's going to happen. And I said, well, when, Mom? You know, is it happening in a year? Is it 2 years? You know, how long will it be before this happens? And she says, it's happening. It's on the verge. I said, okay, well, describe what this person, you know, will look like. Can you describe? She said, she thought for a moment, and she said, well, she'll be of light complexion. I'd say blue eyes, blondish hair. She'll be very intelligent person. She'll come from a fine family. The father will be very quiet, but the father will learn to really, really love you and will really, really like you from the beginning. And I said, okay, and I listened. And I said, Mom, give me a name. Is there a name that comes to you? And she thought for a moment. And she said, Sue, S-U-E. I said, okay, not, I said, I'm dating a person named Suzette or Suzanne. And I said, but she's darker complected. She said, no, you haven't met her. That's not the person. She's light. And her name will be Sue. And so, okay, fast forward a couple days later, I go back home to San Francisco. Now, during the interim, my roommate and I had shared, a telephone. And he was a guitarist and was developing his own guitar business. And he had decided which he had shared with me, that he was going to get his own phone. And while I was gone, he would do the work of connecting another phone for me, in my name. And he did that. And when I got home, I went upstairs and kind of lingered for a little while. And I was about to go down to the famous Haight Street of San Francisco to get some lunch or early dinner. And I was living just above Haight Street. And I was on the verge of going down, and the phone rang. The very first phone ring of this new phone. Huh. And I picked it up, and there was this very sweet voice on the other side. And she asks for a person named Jamie. And I said, well, there's no Jamie here. You must have the wrong number. I said, but it sounds long distance, and where are you calling from? And she said, Denver. And I said, you know, you have a very sweet voice. I don't think I should let you go. I said to her.
Good job,
I said, what is your name? And she was intrigued as well. And because she lingered and didn't hang up right away. And she said, Sue. And I said, so you're Sue from Denver? And she said, yeah. And we started talking. Now, I must say, truly, I had the reading about Sue, but I didn't have the kind of blind faith.
Right.
I am
right.
Somewhat of an academic.
Right.
And it doesn't even have to be. You could be an academic and still have blind faith. But I didn't have blind faith. This has to be Sue. This has to be the one that I will marry. But we did have a nice connection, and we did speak for a while, and we ended the conversation with an agreement that she would send me a picture, and I would send her a photo as well. Now, I went immediately to one of those photo booths and took one of these dark photos, which really didn't look so great, in one of those you know instant photo booths, and which you don't see so much anymore. I don't think I've seen them in years, but I sent her that, and she sent me this beautiful picture of a visit to Florence, Italy, in the Garden of the Vatican.
Oh, wow.
You know, that she had taken in high school on a tour. And I looked at that picture. I looked at that picture, and I have to say, when I looked at that picture, I knew, without a doubt, that this is the person I would marry. I saw such an incredible familiarity and connection and soul connection and soulmate kind of something there. And her name was Sue, and she sent me a little note. And I believe I sent her a note, and Sue saved those notes, and those first notes to each other are in the book.
Right, right.
Early in the book.
Very touching. They're very, very touching from both of you.
So I did marry a Sue. She was blondish. Her father did love me. She did have the light complexion. You know, all of that came true.
And what you raised two children. You have Michael and Jonathan as your mm-hmm. as your two sons, and they're adults now, right?
Yeah,
they're through
yeah.
college.
One's in grad school, just wrapping up grad school at in New York.
Oh, nice, nice. And so you were stayed married for quite a while, but you wrote in the book how you really, in retrospect, I imagine you realize that with the passing of your mother, it put some additional stress within the marriage, and you really put your focus, both of you put your tunnel vision on and your focus in raising the kids and doing your dutiful responsibilities as parents and going through the motions. And I find that in all relationships, there comes a point where it's easy to fall into that rut, and it's easy to fall into, you know, losing that excitement or losing that passion or losing the intimacy that really brought the relationship together. How do you feel the loss of your mother impacted upon the marriage? Because it happened, it happened like in 1999, so 20 mm-hmm. years ago, you know, or,
yep.
You know, 13 yep. years ago. How did that affect you and Sue? Did it make you go within,
mm-hmm.
hard for her to reach you? How did that,
yeah.
how did it affect you?
That's how it, I think that's indeed what did happen. I did go within. I don't think that, I think she tried to reach me, but she was grieving as well. I mean, she loved my mom very much as well. And she tried to be there for me,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think she was able to reach me. I poured myself into my family. I poured myself into the warmth of the family and into the peacefulness of, well, it's not all peaceful raising boys, but into the comfort of the family but at the same time, I went at the end of the long day in the financial world. I went to a place within myself at night, and I would go into the room, and I'd go up into the attic or whatever, and I would try to become comfortable with the loss,
mm-hmm.
with the loss, and I became comfortable, not comfortable, but with the pain, you know, so deep. I mean, you're given only as much as you can handle, and you handle it just as well as you can, and you handle it because of the deep love that you have for a person. It takes a lifetime, and it never goes away, and it you absorb it over a lifetime.
Right.
So I had to make peace with that feeling, that this would take a long time, and to make peace and find that warm place within myself, as well as pouring myself into the family. And I was good to Sue, and Sue was good to me, but we just fell deeper into roles. I think we connected less on a romantic level, in roles other than raising a family. We fell deeper into that, and I fell into a more I'm not going to say isolated, but let's say alone state of mind. And then over time, I think I felt the urgent need to express what I was feeling, to feel more, to feel passion, to be more passionate, to experience life deeply again. And it just was hard to make it happen. And
okay.
That's how it kind of unfolded.
And when did you, how did this unfold in regard to conversation with your wife? I mean, when did you, you know, you talk about it in the book, and it's very heartfelt. It's for anyone who's gone through a divorce, and for anyone who's gone through a divorce with somebody that they came together with believing, you know, this is a soulmate, and then the relationship kind of worked its karma through. so to speak.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's a very painful experience because, you know, when you have a family, you want that family to stay intact, and when it doesn't stay intact, and there has to be a change and a shift, it's an excavation to the deepest core. How did you talk about this? How was this approached? How was this something how did Sue respond? How did she react to this unfolding of the relationship?
Sue was going through a great deal of trauma. I mean, a great deal of pain. I think she was questioning, I think any insecurities that she may have had in her life came out during this period. I think that she felt that she had done everything right, and yet this was still happening, and she was
right.
So close with me and my mom. And I think that she was hurting a great deal, and so she would go through periods of great anger. She would go through periods of sadness. She would go through a tremendous sense of loss, and I wanted to be the medicine for Sue, and she wanted to be the medicine for me, and we couldn't be the medicine for each other, and that was extremely hard because
right.
you want to help each other so deeply because you love each other, and you can't seem to make it happen. You can't, because what you want to help each other about is your marriage, and the marriage is going away. And so it was an extremely hard time for Sue. It was an extremely hard time for me because Sue would become extremely emotional and turbulent. And we decided, actually the boys came to me and said, "Dad, the two of you," and they were, one, John, my younger one was a senior in high school. Michael was off at college. And I think they spoke among themselves, and they both admitted that their parents are in an enormous amount of pain, and that they came to me and said, "Dad, I think you're going to have, you should separate." And when they essentially gave me the permission
wow.
to separate, I realized, I had realized before that I had, that we had to. Sue was now starting to say that we had to. It was so hard for me to move out of this home that I felt comfortable in. But I realized for the health, the mental health of both of us, we were going to have to separate.
Right.
And I did, and I moved out. And that moment when you are sitting on a bunch of boxes for the first time, and I found this apartment overlooking the bay, and I wrote most of my book from that apartment. And that feeling of loss, and yet the feeling of freedom, but the feeling of loss, and what do you do with this freedom, and yet the intimacy and the loss that you feel at the same time and that you never expected to be here, very, very painful. I want to say that men are oftentimes given a, you know, bad, negative reputation in our world because when things fall apart and men are often perceived to be not feeling, or they revert
right.
to a persona that is, you know, helps them get by and survive, and certainly and to block out and to shut down. Well, this is a message to men out there. I mean, if you're going through this, allow yourself to feel. Many of you do. To shut down means it's only going to come up and erupt like a volcano later. Write down your notes, write down your feelings, allow it to come out, recognize that you're doing the best you can. Society sometimes wants to put all the blame on the guy, and really it's
right.
two parties here. And I would simply say that, you know, in the world, the financial world, it's a very, you know, very male world, and I recognized, you know, my soul. And number one, I've always been a writer. I've always been passionate, but I recognize that in this very dry world, I absolutely had to open up and allow myself to be, you know, the deepest human being that I could.
Right.
And to be the
right.
deepest male that I could.
Yeah, and that's stretching yourself, stretching stretching who you are, your perceptions, your feelings, your emotions, and there had to have been a point after some of the healing was being dealt with that you actually felt like a coming home to yourself. Was there? Did
yes.
you feel like through the process of being alone that you
yes.
actually found yourself again?
Yes. I think that, the writing of the book is a journey.
Right.
A journey of the marriage, a journey of my relationships, a journey of the soul, journey of love, a journey of loss, you know, trying to find joy amidst loss. And so in writing the book, certainly it was cathartic.
Right.
As well as I wanted it to be the best literature it could be, but it was also deeply cathartic. And I think I felt more in touch with that voice, and I wrote it, you know, alone in this apartment, in the apartment that I was living in at the time.
And in reading it, because it's a memoir, it comes through, I have in my notes here that it's a cathartic release. So you're talking about that right now. But you
yeah.
have here it's you've got a real spiritual awakening, realization, reckoning. I mean, there's a whole side to you that you go through, one with the loss of your mother, and then two with the loss of the marriage. And then three, in redefining what that relationship with Sue becomes, because, you know, you are a whole sensitive, evolved soul who isn't bashing your ex-wife. You aren't condemning her. You're taking responsibility. You're still looking at her essence and her beauty and her light. And that's something that I think really needs to be talked about when it comes to ending relationships, because
mm-hmm.
there's far too much bashing that goes on upon the other person. And sure, we all have our stuff. You know, it does take two, like you said. But I really, really honored the aspect of how you honored Sue in the book. And that was really a beautiful sentiment that you provided here. So talk about how the unfolding of the new relationship looked like after you left the marriage, and what that looks like today for you and Sue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a period of time where we were friends from the get-go, but I think Sue had to. I mean, even from the time I moved out. The love was there. I mean, that never disappeared. However, Sue had to heal as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sue would sometimes be unavailable if I wanted to reach her. I mean, she might not call me back immediately, although she would eventually do it. Or she would take off for a couple of days and not say she had taken off, or just go on a trip up the coast or something to heal. And I would worry about her.
Right.
I would worry, is everything okay? You know, I can't reach her. I would worry about her. And over time, I think, and this is over a period of time, we would start to check in with each other, not all the time, but recognize that I might worry about her, or that she might worry about me, and that we would continue to check in and let each other know we were okay. It was actually a little too painful in the beginning to go to a lot of dinners together, but we did now and then, and we both remained in contact with the boys. And when the holidays came, we continued to do things as a family,
mm-hmm.
and continue even more so. We've become very, very good friends. Deeply good friends, lifelong good friends, but over time this evolved through trial and error, if you will, through trying to learn what our new relationship would be like, what each one of us, how each one of us would adapt to this new situation, and try to be fair and considerate of the other and respectful of each other's pain. And so over time, we wound up getting to dinner on occasion, continuing to do events that we did as married couple, going to see a concert together, going to you know, a baseball game or a football game and sharing the tickets that we shared for the various events that we would go to, like the symphony, we continue to share, although not all the time, but we continue to keep that connection alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, I think that we each recognized that we were not, at first we didn't know whether we were going to come back together, but the bridge back together seemed to get further, from one end to the other seemed to be getting further and further apart or wider and wider. And it started to become clear that for whatever reason, something was happening in our psyches, obstacles were being put in our way, whether we were creating them or they existed in the external world, and that something was occurring in the universe that was making it less and less likely that we would move back in together, that we would once again share the marriage. And so we remained, because we continued to be friends and the friendship became deeper and we loved each other, it was very hard to recognize that we were in limbo and that eventually we would have to move on with our lives and actually get a divorce.
Right.
And it took a few years before we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we finally did do it. And I must say that there is a stigma associated with divorce. And as you say, people bash, and the term divorce almost becomes the connotation. It almost has a connotation of bashing, and actually, it can be the opposite. It can
be,
it can be respect. It can be love. It could be a recognition that you're honoring each other and being fair to each other. And it doesn't mean that all the good things in the relationship have to come to an end.
Right, right. That's beautifully said, and I hope that more people grasp that message, because it's something. There's a reason why you came together, and just because the part of the relationship has ended doesn't mean that you can't honor and respect the value of why you were brought together.
Mm-hmm.
And in your state, you know, you have two children that came out of it. So that's, you know, that's a miracle and a blessing right there. And that's
absolutely, and very, very, very. All of our kids are special. They're
right.
They're very musical and talented in the arts, and just a joy.
And that's, you know, and that really says a lot, because you're talking from a place of, like I said in the beginning of the interview, you're coming from a place of your profession being very left brain, and yet in talking to you, you're a very feeling person. So I love the integration of both your left and right brain. Those are my favorite people, because for me, they're the most grounded. If someone too far off into right brain is just
right.
Too far off for me.
Right.
That
is. Yeah, there is some. Yes, my father and my mom, they both. There was some balance that came from that.
Yeah, that was a good balance, and this has been a really heartfelt show, and I've really, really loved speaking with you today, Bruce. This has been a real eye-opener, I think, for people to look at relationships through a different lens and a different perspective, and to really honor the heartfelt feelings that go on with loss, both
yeah.
on a, you know, visible, personal, intimate level, as well as parental loss and the feelings that are attached to that. We have about a minute left, and I want to direct people again to your book. And the title of the book is If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away, Bruce Farrell Rosen. And it's a wonderful book to really reintroduce yourself back to your heart, because it definitely pulls on the heartstrings. Thank you so much, Bruce. Do you have any last words of insight and wisdom you'd like to share with the listeners today?
I think I would say that our inheritance as human beings is that there is joy at the very core of our being, and it becomes very difficult sometimes to find that joy. But joy is doing what you love, listening to music, going to an event, allowing yourself just to be at peace with yourself. There are so many obstacles out there. There's so many layers and responsibilities and obligations, that we sometimes lose touch with what we love, with who we are, with our own sense of joy. And that joy is there. It's easy to find. You just have to let yourself go and let yourself love yourself and let yourself enjoy your life and find
Amen.
Joy.
Beautiful, beautiful statement. Thank you again so much, Bruce. This has been a real joy. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for being on Unlimited Realities. And listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to listen to Bruce Farrell Rosen in talking about his book, If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away. God bless all of you. Have a wonderful week. Thank you again, Bruce. Take care.
Thank you, Lisa.
Bye-bye.